of fiscal cliffs and bribes. Text on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
And I'm sort of standing on the precipice of the fiscal cliff, looking over and saying that neither party has the solution, and I'm not willing to pay a bribe to get anything done.
Well, very good. And I think that that's probably where the sentiments of the majority of our listeners lie on that. And we're going to be talking more about these fiscal cliff negotiations and some of the machinations behind it, which in one sense accounts to, well, maybe not so much bribery, if not threats and intimidations, in order to get a certain outcome. But first, for those of you who listen to our regular weekday show on Friday, you know that we talked about a really positive thing. It was a ruling by U.S. District Court Judge Mark Watson of the Southern District of Ohio to say that the case that Mike Tommaso and Liberty Coins in Delaware, Ohio had brought, saying that the Ohio Precious Metals Dealers Act was unconstitutional, well, Judge Watson upheld the preliminary injunction that they requested to keep the state from trying to enforce this act against Tommaso and others. And we talked about that on Friday's program. But since that time, Maurice Thompson over at the 1851 Center for Constitutional Law, who was the lead attorney for the plaintiffs, Mike Tommaso and Liberty Coins, wrote a very interesting and I would say rather revealing, Charles, analysis of the decision of that case so far. As we know that that was, again, on a temporary restraining order and a preliminary injunction, which means that they will still be holding a trial on the merits coming up sometime at the beginning of 2013. But in the meantime, right now, the state cannot enforce their edicts against Tommaso and Liberty Coins because the judge basically said this law violates the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States.
And the way it's set up is that's exactly what they were doing, because it basically only affected those who put themselves out, quote unquote, put themselves out as being willing to buy precious metals, rings, teeth, gold chains, platinum chains, that kind of thing. All kinds of junk pennies, that kind of stuff.
All the foreign coinage before the euro.
Yeah.
That's not made out of an actual precious metal.
Which is a lot.
Which is a lot, yeah. And you can go into pretty much any coin dealer shop and they're going to have some kind of a bucket, barrel, cask, or chest that's going to be full of all of these coins of the world that you can buy by the pound. Because
yeah.
These are coins from countries who have either repudiated their coinage, switched to a different currency, or something else of that matter. I mean, you can find coins from all over the face of the planet. It's kind of fun. I've done that with my kids. But
yeah, take for instance Mexico, which has redesigned its currency like twice in the last 30 years.
Right, exactly. And so what you've got here is the fact that what the state was trying to do, as spelled out by attorney Maurice Thompson, was basically trying to say that if they engaged in commercial speech, therefore putting out advertising or saying they'd be willing to buy gold and precious metals, that therefore that required them to take a license from the state in any way, shape, or form. And what Thompson, the 1851 Center, and Tommaso argued against that was basically that the First Amendment applies to and protects commercial speech, such as that advertising. And that what the state was trying to say, that the reason why they did this was to reduce thefts. Now, Chuck, this was incredibly interesting because that wasn't their only argument. And if you read down into Maurice Thompson's analysis of it, and this is the one that stopped me and I said, hey, we have to continue to talk about this today. Basically, the defendants, the state, have been giving a lot of exemptions to a lot of businesses of this act. But when it came to precious metals dealers like coin shops, they weren't willing to cut any kind of an exemption because they were saying that this licensing scheme is quote unquote narrowly tailored. Now that's a key phrase that you have to have in order to pass a constitutional free speech challenge. It was narrowly tailored to protect against theft, fraud, or terrorism. Okay.
Terrorism.
Chuck, how many terrorists do you know are in there buying and selling their scrap gold jewelry or their high school graduation rings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, about the only precious metal that any terrorist would probably be interested in would possibly be a copper jacketed hollow point.
And I don't think they sell those at Liberty Coin.
And they wouldn't be selling them. They would be buying them.
That's right.
And Liberty Coin, coin dealers, unless they are a very specialty shop, generally don't also deal in guns. Now, what's interesting about this, Barry, is who does deal both in coins and guns?
Let me think. That would be pawn shops.
Pawn shops. And who is specifically exempted from this regulation?
Pawn shops. Now, get this. Now, I want to keep on this because the Department of Commerce, in their arguments to the court as to why they needed to have this law upheld and they needed to basically put the boot on Mike Tomasso's neck, says that the law prevents, quote, fraud, money laundering, theft, and terrorism by requiring those who wish to engage in the business of buying from the public gold, silver, and other precious metals to be licensed. Really? If I'm out there and I want to buy your gold and your silver, that's going to prevent terrorism somehow if I have to get a license from the state? The more I look at this argument, Chuck, the more I'm looking at the state thinking, you guys are really trying to be just like your federal brothers, where
exactly.
The Commerce Clause covers everything, and what the Commerce Clause doesn't, the Patriot Act will, for us to spend our power anywhere we want to extend it.
Basically, what they're attempting to do is tar with a very wide brush. Anyone who would engage in these things must be thinking or is a potential terrorist. Now, come on. Seriously. Mike Tomasso has been in this business, the guy who basically originated this suit, has been in this business now since you asked me yesterday. I have discovered how long Mike's been in the business.
Okay.
Almost 30 years.
Almost 30 years. I knew it had been at least 20, so. Almost
not quite.
30 years.
Almost 30.
He's been in the business of buying and selling coins and scrap gold and precious metals without ever having to have a license. And you know what's funny, Chuck? It's been about 30 years since the Precious Metals Act went into effect.
Yeah, exactly. So the first time in 30 years they decide they're going to enforce this regulation. This is the problem, Barry, when laws are passed to alleviate non-problems.
Mm-hmm. That's
now,
right.
I would love to look into what was going on 30 years ago, and I can just about tell you what was going on 30 years ago because I remember it very well. If you'll remember, the first real spike in the price of gold and silver. In fact, right. If you'll remember, the Hunt brothers were attempting to corner the silver market.
Right.
And silver was still being used as, for instance, a photographic metal. And it was being used in also still as a coinage metal. And in that time, remember, the bottom fell out of the market because essentially what happened was the government dumped its reserve. I mean, the Hunt brothers were not doing this in secret. They basically said, we want a corner of the silver market, and here's how we're going to do it. They attempted to claim that they were pulling off some kind of a fraud. The Hunt brothers were very open about what they were doing. We want to own the majority of the silver market. There's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, that's why nobody was ever indicted or charged or nothing was ever, because they were very open right up front. This is what we're doing. And in fact, a lot of people were buying and selling silver at that time. And also, if you'll recall, the price of gold, because of what was going on from the Carter administration and the economic doldrums we had been in since the mid-1970s, and it got really bad during the Carter years, the price of gold went up to, I think, oh gosh, it went all the way up to $1,000 an ounce.
Shocking.
Well, where is it now?
As of yesterday, it was $1,678 an ounce.
I was going to say, just hovering around $1,700 an ounce. Well, guess what, folks? That's right now looking like a floor.
Yes, it is.
That's looking like a floor.
That's the reason why I've been going out and looking at some investments, Chuck.
As the ceiling's looking like 3,400 from what I'm reading.
Yes.
So this is suddenly the reason why of the great interest. Now, who wants to corner the market? Who wants to be in charge of and who's specifically exempted in this law?
Well, first of all, the state wants to be in charge of everything. But
they basically want their cut.
But yeah, of course. And one of the groups that's specifically exempted now. That was part of the reason why the judge granted the injunction, because he said that the breadth and the number of the exemptions actually undercut the state's argument that it's narrowly tailored. It's like, well, wait a minute. If this was narrowly tailored to do all the things you're claiming it's doing, you would have been giving out blanket exemptions to groups like pawn brokers.
I'm going to make a prediction. I am going to predict that based on this decision, that in the Ohio legislature come spring, there's going to be a new bill introduced that does not exempt pawn brokers. Then we will see how powerful the pawn broker lobbying group is.
Well, you know, Chuck, part of the reason why I got interested in this issue, not just because it's a liberty issue, was because I was contacted by a representative from the coin dealers because another piece of legislation, House Bill 530, was being introduced that would have added more regulations into the precious metals dealers law, creating even more hoops for coin dealers to jump through that were not being expended to the exempted groups who got exemptions under the original law.
Yeah.
So, again, it was all to prevent. It was state representative's house got broken into and his wife's jewelry was stolen. And by the time they got it tracked down, it had already been sold and scrapped. And so he was all upset. And so he blamed the coin dealer or the precious metals dealer who bought the jewelry, but didn't blame the police force who, by law, are supposed to go and collect sales information from the dealers on a regular basis, daily. They're supposed to, if they have one in their community, they're supposed to go by and collect the list of what they sold daily so that they can look, see if anything matches the description of stolen property that's been reported to that same police jurisdiction.
Well, how long ago? That's been 6 or 8 weeks ago that we talked about that on our radio show we did. And I don't remember exactly, and I haven't had time to go back through the archives and look. You can find that if you really want to by going to www.principledpolicy.com and doing a search. Put in House Bill, what was it, House Bill?
530.
Also put in coin dealers, those kind of search terms, and you will find it. And at that time, we decried the fact that, and let everybody know that what was going to happen if the kickback was the cops aren't doing their job in monitoring this thing, it's not the coin dealers that are at fault, it's the cops. All the coin dealers do is exactly what they're supposed to do. They prepare the lists, and the police don't come by and pick it up and check it.
No.
We knew what the hue and cry was going to be. Boo-hoo-hoo, we need more money. Boo-hoo-hoo, we don't have the manpower. Boo-hoo-hoo, we need more resources. Because that's always what you get when you do a non-necessary law to try to put the onus on the business owner rather than law enforcement where it belongs.
Indeed. Indeed. But Chuck, you know, in this particular lawsuit that Tommaso Liberty Coins and the 1851 Center filed, basically the judge, now again, this was a preliminary injunction, ladies and gentlemen, and as I mentioned, it was 28 pages in length, and this judge basically was laying out the entire case, basically telling the state, you're not going to win this one. You might as well fold up and go home. But we're going to go through a trial anyway sometime in the beginning of the year, so here's what you can expect. He says that, first, the department failed to show how holding oneself out as willing to purchase precious metals contributed to the evils the state seeks to prevent. So in other words, and then it says the defendants have also not shown how requiring a license only for purchasers of precious metals who engage in commercial speech directly and materially advance those interests. In other words, okay, guys, this is selective enforcement, and you're picking on a group because you think they're weak.
So yes.
The next point, that the state has not shown that forcing those who engage in commercial speech to obtain a license is reasonable, and that the restriction proposed that's in the state law on commercial speech of this narrow group, the coin dealers, is more extensive than necessary. So, Chuck, there we go. That, you know, he's basically telling them, you guys don't have a leg to stand on, State of Ohio, Department of Commerce. You guys are trampling all over the First Amendment free speech rights. You're trampling over their Fourth Amendment rights. You're trampling over their Fifth Amendment rights. Now, part of the law also would allow for the state or local law enforcement at any time they chose, without notice, to be able to come into the coin shop and confiscate the records for review. Now, Chuck, if the FDA did that to your business, how long could you stay in business?
Actually, the FDA can't do that.
well, that's another thing we got to deal with.
yeah. The reason why this interests me so deeply is the fact that I work in a highly regulated industry in which basically, and we need to do a show with this, I'm going to contact Scott Tipps, who's the head of the National Health Federation, who's also a radio talk show host. So we'll trade radio shows. But we'll interview Scott, in which he talks about the fact that what really has happening in the supplement industry is that the supplement industry allowed the camel's nose in the tent. We understand the need for regulation. We've all heard this horror stories about people who have done stupid things while manufacturing this, that, or another thing for ingestion. And we're not questioning the need for regulation. We're questioning the degree of regulation. And one of the degrees of regulation is that the FDA can just basically come in on demand. They can take a look at my records at any point. They can pull things off my shelf. They can do this. They can do that. They can do another thing. They can look at all kinds of stuff. That really is outside their purview. And the fact is, I could probably be better regulated by state authorities like the Department of Agriculture. And I have had regulatory visits from the State Department of Agriculture. And they have made helpful suggestions on a number of things. And the fact is that this is a problem at the federal level. Now, you're right. The FDA could probably come in. If they really wanted to get me, the regulations are so onerous and so complex and so nebulous that I could be fined out of business tomorrow. If they wanted to do that, I would be out looking for work, probably as a lab technician someplace. This is the problem you run into when you build regulation after law after regulation after law into a thing that doesn't really need it. In other words, Barry, for instance, they're trying to regulate this industry like the gun industry. They're trying to regulate the coin industry like the gun industry. Well, the gun industry shouldn't be regulated this way. Why should the coin industry be regulated this way? And the fact is, to give you an analogy, my industry is being regulated like the pharmaceutical industry. Well, how many people a year do pharmaceuticals kill or maim versus things that I do that kill or maim? In fact, I can brag that I've never killed anybody. We've never poisoned
anybody. Wait a minute. Does that mean that you've maimed people?
We've never maimed anybody either.
Okay.
All right. And you take there's no pharmaceutical company of a similar size, but because we're tiny. But you take any pharmaceutical company. I actually won a lawsuit over a trademark dispute once by asking this question and requiring it. That is, how many people has your drug killed or maimed? We want the records. And they said, you can't ask that question. I go, hey, this is open discovery on a lawsuit. You've already got my discovery. I want yours. We want the answer. You can't make us answer that. And my attorney said, oh, yes, we can.
All of a sudden, and they dried up and went away, didn't they?
All of a sudden, they had came up with this fantastic agreement where I couldn't have a registered trademark, but I could take a TM, which is a common law trademark. And they agreed to that because they knew that if that information came out, they were going to find themselves swimming in lawsuits. We don't have that problem in the vitamin industry. The only place where you find it is in places where people are doing silly things. I don't want a broad brush here, but very often in the bodybuilder market, you'll see people that are putting out things that are supplements that are absolutely in quantities that are dangerous. And I've had people say, you could make $1 million doing this. And I go, yeah. And I could also hurt people, which I don't want to do. That's not what I'm in this business for. I'm not in this business to mislead people. I'm in this business to help people out who want to take a different route than they're being told. That is exactly what's going on with the precious metal dealers. They don't want to go the pawn shop route because very often there's a lot of stuff built into that where the pawn shop will essentially pay you way under the market value so that they can get the market value. Now, coin and metal dealers do the same thing. but the cuts don't seem to be quite as deep. I think it's been my experience, very slight experience, that you get a better deal at a coin and metal dealer.
Oh, I'm sure that you do. You know, it's interesting, Chuck, and you posited this a little bit earlier, and as I'm looking over Maurice Thompson's article here from the 1851 Center, ohioconstitution.org is where you'd find this, and we're going to post up on our site as well at principledpolicy.com. He explains down the bottom that heightened enforcement of the Precious Metal Dealers Act by the Department of Commerce comes in response to accelerated lobbying and financial contributions to candidates by the pawnbrokers industry, which is exempt from the regulations, and a direct competitor of those who are subject to the act. So money talks in politics, ladies and gentlemen, and looks like possibly Department of Commerce Director David Goodman and possibly the Kasich administration in general, you might have been getting caught with their hand in the cookie jar on this one.
Well, listen to the following sentence right after what you just read. The enforcement, which would have put many coin dealers out of business, also comes at a time of rising precious metals prices where an increasing number of Ohioans seek to use gold and silver to protect their savings against potential inflation caused by federal government increases in the money supply. This is a vicious circle. And what was happening here was the pawnbrokers were working to achieve a monopoly.
Of course they were.
State regulation to achieve a monopoly in the precious metal and coin business. Period. And the state, in its infinite wisdom, was doing its best to make sure that coin dealers had a monopoly. Now, if you present it to them that way, oh, boo-hoo-hoo, no, that's not what we really meant to do. Of course it is. Barry, this is the exact reason why we have a specific company named in the Ohio Constitution who's allowed to run casinos in Ohio.
Right, because they wanted a monopoly. And, oh, look at what the Ohio legislature is doing just this week, Chuck. They're working on a bill that would all but ban the internet cafes. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm in favor of that. I'll give you that. I'm in favor of because I see them in West Virginia and in other states, the quote-unquote cafes that are basically internet gambling halls. But the reasons why they're doing this is because the casino operators don't like the competition. And since they're now in the Ohio Constitution with their constitutional casinos, and they couldn't quite stop the legislature from wanting to give slots to the racetracks in order to get them on the road to becoming full-blown casinos, they went and bought the racetracks. The vast majority of the tracks in Ohio are now owned by the casino companies. And you can go back, and I can provide you with documentation on that way back, articles, etc. But that's a true statement. But the problem is that there are so many of these little internet cafes out there, Chuck, these little gambling parlors, that in order for the casinos to buy them all up would probably be a little cost prohibitive. So what's the easy way of doing it? Get some donations and get a bill at the state house that would put them out of business.
Regulate them out of business. Well, you know what else is going to happen? I'm willing to bet. Well, to coin a phrase.
Well, willing to bet. Yeah, that may not be the best phrase to coin while we're talking about this subject.
Also, the games of skill places are going to get regulated out of business.
Yes.
Because, of course, these aren't really games of skill at all. They were always gambling.
Of course. And I am an opponent to gambling. I was not in favor of the casinos. I'm not in favor of the horse tracks with the betting. I'm not in favor of dog tracks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, off-site betting parlors. I'm not in favor of any of that stuff. So I do understand the argument, though, that you have certain groups who have carved themselves out a special place in the heart of Ohio, the casinos, by writing themselves specifically into the Constitution. Well, Chuck, that brings up another issue. And folks, this is how we start putting puzzle pieces together.
Right.
Ohio right now we just, at the ballot this fall, rejected State Issue 1, which was the call for a state constitutional convention. It was overwhelmingly rejected by the voters. But during this last year or so, the Ohio legislature had passed a bill that created the Ohio Constitutional Modernization Commission. Well, this commission, which has, I believe, 34 members, and I think it's like 14 or so members of the General Assembly and 20 members of the public, who include people like Bob Taft and Joanne Davidson and others that our listeners would know when they heard, are tasked with looking at the Ohio Constitution and saying, well, how do we spruce it up a little bit? How do we make it 21st century? How do we get rid of archaic things like, oh, I don't know, Chuck, maybe the Right of Citizens Initiative petition, maybe that controversial marriage amendment? How do we get rid of some of those things? Well, the Constitutional Modernization Commission is going to be giving their recommendations to the upcoming General Assembly when it convenes in January. And I'm sure, Chuck, that if they haven't already, there are probably going to be some provisions in there to ban things like the games of skill parlors. And if they don't get this Internet Cafe bill done, they'll probably have that in there as well.
Well, there's something else that will be in jeopardy, and that will be the Ohio Healthcare Freedom Amendment.
Ah, yes. And that was one we hadn't even touched on yet. But yeah, we've touched on it on the program, but haven't touched on it in discussion before now on this Constitutional Modernization Commission. Of course, that will be in jeopardy because we can't have people arguing for the nullification of, say, Obamacare based upon the state's already existent law because, well, now that they've Judge Roberts at the Supreme Court has given the green light to Obamacare, well, then the Supremacy Clause kicks in, so we're just going to have to take that out of our Constitution because we can't challenge federal law that way.
Well, here's the problem, Barry. As you and I have discussed with a couple of other people high up in certain government circles, the fact is that Roberts' decision actually left open the door for states refusing to partake in Obamacare.
That's right.
Even though Obamacare, they said it was a tax, there is no taxing entity named. And the fact is that the decision directly says, and if the states don't want to play, then you can't make them. So
well, that's exactly what that says. But the idea is going to be one that's going to have to be yelled loud and long by our state legislators in order to keep the talking heads, the pundits, and the federal government from saying, oh, supremacy clause, supremacy clause.
Well, the supremacy clause, the now grossly abused supremacy clause, it's sort of a tarp that stretches over any size building, one size fits all. And of course, the Constitution is clear, and we'd be happy to teach it to you in one of our Institute on the Constitution classes and teach you why this is true. But the fact is, the supremacy clause is very clear. The laws that are supreme, the supreme law of the land, is only those that have been specifically delegated by the states to the federal government. That is contained in Article 1, Section 8, not in Article 6. So, if you want to find out more about one of our Institute on the Constitution classes, go to www.principledpolicy.com and send us an email. Or get in contact with us. There's phone numbers, there's emails, there's all kinds of contact information. We want to teach the Constitution to you and have you give you an original intent understanding of that document. And this is the way you learn how to put these puzzle pieces together and foresee what is coming, because you've heard us today do in several different ways tell you what's going to come up. And believe me, we don't have a crystal ball. We're not neither prophets nor sons of prophets. We can merely see what's going to happen by following the path and thinking about how, through a Christian biblical worldview lens, these guys think and what they're going to do next. And we want you to be able to do that.
Oh, absolutely.
So give us a call and we'll help you set up and help you. We'll teach the class for you. It's a minimal charge. It's a 12-week class. The cost is $60, $5 a week. Well worth it. And we don't, any monies that come in over and above the cost of the materials go over to a charitable and you get to deduct it. They go over to Camp American and you get to deduct that cost if we collect more than the books cost and the materials. So that being said, you will get an education in how the Constitution works that is simply unbeatable. And that includes the free one I frankly think that this course material is far superior to that put out by Hillsdale University for free.
Yes, I've taken that course.
Yeah, Barry's taking it. I'm thinking about taking it. And the fact is that from what I've seen, the materials and the lectures simply don't match up. So, it's a free course. You get what you pay for.
Well, that's true. So, but, you know, Chuck, with that, we're getting ready to plan, I think, a new class in the Columbus area sometime after the beginning of the year. We've had a number of folks who contacted us wanting to have something going, and right now I think we're just looking for a location, right?
We're negotiating. I'm basically got some feelers out to some people, and we're looking to put together a Central Ohio class.
Okay, so basically that's what we're dealing with. But, you know, when it comes right down to it, Chuck, now the other thing that I got thinking about, this thing with the Ohio Constitutional Modernization Commission, and when you brought up the whole issue of the healthcare reform, one of the public members of this particular organization is an attorney in Cincinnati by the name of Janet Abere. Well, it's her middle name that's important. It's Janet Gilligan Abere. I believe Janet Gilligan Abere is the daughter of former Ohio Governor John Gilligan. Now, quick question for you, Chuck. Who is one of the other daughters of former Ohio Governor John Gilligan?
I knew the question you were going to ask, and I know the answer. It's Kathleen Sebelius, who is the head of the Department of Health and Human Services.
For the Obama administration. That's right.
So what a shock. There is a mole in the Ohio Constitution Modernization Commission.
Well, possibly so. Now, I took a look at Ms. Abere's bio at her law firm's website, and it looks like she does a whole lot of pharmaceutical litigation in relation to her business. She works she's a managing partner at Berg Simpson Law Firm. And had a little problem with my internet there for a moment. The managing shareholder of Berg Simpson, Eldridge, Hirsch, and Jardine in Cincinnati. And so she does quite a bit in pharmaceutical products liability as defense counsel for the pharmaceutical companies.
That doesn't mean anything. I'll be quite honest. I've seen how these lobbyists and lawyer types work inside the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Don't kid yourself. The drug companies love the idea of socialized healthcare.
Yes, they do.
Because it's a guaranteed revenue stream. In fact, what will happen, Barry, is that businesses like mine will not be part of that revenue stream. In other words, holistic medicine and holistic remedies and the kinds of things that I do will be specifically exempted. Because, now, again, let's put another puzzle piece in, of something called Codex Alimentarius. Codex Alimentarius is the European pharmaceutical code. And essentially what it does, the Codex Alimentarius does, is put pharmaceutical companies in charge of pharmaceutical regulation. Now, it's through the auspices of government agency, but there is an uncomfortable relationship between pharmaceutical companies and there's a very uncomfortably close relationship between pharmaceutical companies and regulatory. They trade back and forth personnel. In other words, one of the big things that pharmaceutical companies always do, always, is they take former FDA people into their regulatory departments. It's a silent agreement. My grandfather and uncle worked for a company for years who refused to play along in this game. And guess what happened to that company? They couldn't get any new drugs approved.
Well, that doesn't surprise me in any way, shape, or form. They couldn't get drugs approved.
So the idea that this woman works as a pharmaceutical attorney and possibly lobbyist, that doesn't mean anything, Barry. It's more condemning than acquitting.
No, I wasn't trying to acquit. That's exactly where I was heading to with that.
Okay, good. Because that's the way this industry works.
Okay.
And if guys like me are too small, first of all, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't take on anybody from the FDA unless they were repentant, which they won't. There are a few of those out there, but not very many.
Oh, that's true. But you know, Chuck, that kind of takes us to the next issues that we're going to be talking about,
yeah.
which are things that are happening at the federal level. You know, we talked about what's happening at the state level, but we're going to talk a little bit what's happening at the federal level, specifically in our Congress, as they're dealing with the pending, and let's say it's in its full impact, fiscal cliff.
Yeah.
Which, honestly, ladies and gentlemen, is a made-up term. I think Ben Bernanke was the first one who threw that out there and made that reference to a fiscal cliff. And what that fiscal cliff is that if Congress couldn't get its act together and come up with a budget that actually reined in the runaway, out-of-control spending of government, there was a provision in the last authorization that said if you didn't get it done by January 1st of 2013, if you remember the super committee of 12 that met and all of these things when they raised the debt ceiling, remember that was all part of this deal, that if they didn't get anything done and didn't make some cuts by January of 2013, then automatic spending cuts, which they call sequestration, Chuck. And it's interesting they use that term because sequestration means we're just not going to release any money for these particular things. It isn't like they're cutting the spending. They just can't release more money because, well, they frankly don't have it. So they're not cutting back on the things that they want to spend on. They're just saying we're just not going to pump. We're not going to pump dollars to them right now. By law, we're not going to be able to do that. And we're going to have to raise taxes. And, of course, it's been made a huge issue throughout the land. The hue and cry about we're heading to the fiscal cliff has been almost without ceasing. But what we're really getting down to, Chuck, is the whole idea that, well, honestly, this problem could have been avoided if we'd have had some leadership in Congress. And yes, that's right. I'm laying the blame for where we are now squarely at the feet of not Barack Obama, but John Boehner, who is the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, and who has the leadership role in getting this job done and cutting spending and getting the budget back in line. And quitting this runaway massive, we've gone over $16 trillion in federal debt. They've blown past the ceiling, Chuck, or getting ready to.
Well, here's what I'm going to tell you. And this is going to sound kind of harsh to people out there who have been highly critical of certain soon-to-be former members of the House of Representatives. If you'd listened to Ron Paul in 2005, this would not be going on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not.
That, in fact, if you'd listened to Paul throughout the 1980s when he was a member of Congress, none of this would be going on. We'd be basically still continuing on in a boom period. But the fact is that everybody, and I have to laugh about this, Bush's stimulus was good, Obama's was bad. No, Bush's was bad too. The fact is that you can't fix this problem, as proven by the Great Depression. You cannot fix this problem by pumping gobboons of money into the economy from the top end.
No.
The money has to come from the bottom end, the production end, not the regulatory end. And how can we say that? Money is money. No, it's not. Because when it comes in from the bottom end, that money does a whole lot of other things. There's an old saying that a dollar goes around seven times. A private industry dollar goes around seven times. A government dollar goes somewhere between once and twice around. So what's the payoff? The payoff is, had we not gone into this tremendous debt, we would not be looking at anything like a quote-unquote fiscal cliff. I think a lot of people don't even know what the fiscal cliff is. They think about it in terms of, well, it's just a tax increase for the rich. And that is what the news media is trying to push it. Folks, you don't seem to understand. There is not enough revenue on that end of the scale. There aren't enough rich to tax enough to make up a $16 trillion deficit. And really, when you get right down to it, $90 trillion in unfunded mandates, I mean, basically unfunded things out in the future. In other words, our Social Security, our Medicare, our Medicaid, all that stuff, is sitting out there unfunded. And as the population gets older and older and older and older, we're about to hit that iceberg. Now, how are we going to handle it? Are we going to continue to raise taxes? Folks, the only way to raise enough revenue is to raise taxes on the middle class. Now, you brought up Boehner. Boehner knows this. This is why they're running this scam campaign, Barry. We're going to raise revenues without raising rates. How do you raise revenues without raising tax rates? This idea that somehow raising taxes without raising rates is going to be okay, here's what we're going to lose. Charitable deductions.
Right.
Home mortgage deductions.
Correct.
And, of course, we're going to lose deductions for medical expenses because, after all, that's going to be paid for by the government. So we shouldn't be having to buy things like that. That's all going to be subsidized. We can't have you having that deductible. There are all kinds of the child care credits are going to have to go away. All kinds of stuff. I mean, Boehner was talking about $800 billion in new revenue over a period of years.
Right. Which it's interesting, Chuck, because you think about this now, and I say this because Congressman Louie Gohmert from Texas, who is a very strong conservative, basically has come out publicly and said, listen, guys, we went over the fiscal cliff last August in the 2011 because when we didn't get a budget done and we went in and agreed to the debt ceiling bill, and that, of course, that was a capitulation by John Boehner agreeing to the debt ceiling bill without any real cuts and promises that Democrats were not going to, that neither party was going to allow cuts to Medicare, et cetera. He said on August 2nd, 2011, they reached the deal to raise the debt ceiling by $2.4 trillion and appointed the super committee, which Ohio's own Rob Portman was part of that super committee, to find a minimum of $1.2 trillion in cuts. So in other words, we raised that ceiling by 2.4, and then half of it you got to find in cuts. Well, the committee didn't get any agreement. That's why we're sitting here with more across-the-board cuts to defense and domestic spending that are coming up on January 1st, along with those tax increases. So to have John Boehner sit here and talk about how the president has to provide a plan to Congress, when his plan alone doesn't really cut it, it increases revenue going into the federal government by $800 billion. Now, okay, we've stepped down from $2.4 trillion in debt ceiling increase. We were supposed to find $1.2 trillion in cuts. Well, he's dropped that down to having $800 billion in, well, more revenues. So you're not cutting anything. You're just closing off people's ability to keep their own money. And then he has the gall to turn around and basically says, well, you know, if the president doesn't agree with us, that he should submit his own proposal. Chuck, that's not leadership. John Boehner is the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. The House, all appropriations measures must begin in the House of Representatives, and they and they alone are supposed to be making the laws, not the President of the United States. John Boehner is basically just playing fast and loose with the fact that he's failing at his job as a leader.
Well, Barry, we've been saying for how long now, since John Boehner took the office, that the man's in need of a spine donor. He really needs a spine transplant, and that's not going to happen. This guy, we warned people when he took the office, he wasn't, you know, we went to meetings where people were turning cartwheels and saying how wonderful, we're going to get all this pro-life legislation through. Have we passed a single piece of pro-life legislation while John Boehner's been in the office?
Well, no, but he can argue that, well, we send it to the Senate and they don't do anything with it. But, you know, well, Chuck, that's part of the reason why your real test of somebody as a leader comes when if the House is in Republican hands and the Senate is in Republican hands, to see what they do. It's too easy for them to do the Washington dodge to say, well, we tried. Well, that's what he's doing here with Obama. Well, we sent a proposal, but if they won't negotiate with us, then you come up with your own proposal. Speaker Boehner, your proposal's horrible. I wouldn't engage this if I were the president. I'd be like, are you kidding me? But, of course, this president wants more spending not less. Hopefully, at some point, we'll finally get somebody in there as president who actually wants to reduce the level of federal spending.
Well, Barry, let's talk about that, because what's going on here is we're getting doublespeak from the media.
Yes.
The media is saying, well, they're talking about all these spending cuts. No, no, no. There's no spending cuts. There are cuts. This is the same thing that happened in the 80s. There are cuts in the increase of growth.
Well, exactly, because it's interesting you bring this up, Chuck, because on our favorite news site, CNSnews.com, and I think I sent you a link to it, so it should go up on our website, the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, has basically did an analysis of where we are right now. And they're showing that our current laws that are in place right now bring a 55% increase in annual federal spending and $4.25 trillion increase in the debt ceiling. Now, Chuck, this is current law. This is what John Boehner wants to add $800 billion in more spending to. There are no significant cuts. You're right. It is a cut in an increase, but it's not a cut in the increase that's already been enacted into law that if they don't do something right away is going to impact and it's going to take place. Now, this is over the next 10 years. Now, you remember the United States already lost its AAA bond rating by Standard & Poor's because they couldn't come to the agreement to stave off raising the debt ceiling, and they dropped them to AA+. Now, their recommendation was that they had to have $4 trillion in real cuts over the next 10 years in order for Standard & Poor's to even think about or considering giving the United States back that AAA bond rating. We're going the wrong direction. They're talking about another $4 trillion in debt ceiling increase that they're looking at doing with this current spending. So for Boehner to do this, it is ridiculous. Now, of course, we can sit here and say this because we're not members of Congress. Because if we were members of Congress, saying anything against John Boehner would lead to us losing our committee posts. Because that's what John Boehner did to four members of the Republican Conference, all conservatives, mind you, this last week, as they did not like the proposal that John Boehner put forward. Four members who were removed from the budget panel included Tim Holzkamp from Kansas, Justin Amash from Michigan, Walter Jones of North Carolina, and David Schweikert of Arizona. And Boehner and his leadership team pulled the Republican conference members together in a private room and basically said, we're watching how you vote to determine whether or not you should stay on these committees. Chuck, that's a veiled threat. Actually, it's not even too veiled of a threat. It's an outright threat. You don't vote the way we tell you to vote, we will punish you.
Well,
this is not the hallmark of a leader. This is the thrashings of a tyrant.
Well, absolutely, Barry. And in fact, I sent you an article, and I'm having a little trouble finding it, so I'll keep looking for it so we can post it. But basically, the secretary for the chairman of the steering committee said, hey, we didn't make any decision about throwing these guys off. That came down from on high.
Yeah, well, so, it's interesting, too, because Tim Holzkamp, who was one of the members, is pushing the issue. And what he's basically said was, okay, guys, if this is all about our votes, then I want to see the list of the votes used by the steering committee to reward or punish members. In other words, I want to see what votes that I didn't cast right to make you pull me off of a committee. Guess what he's responded with? Dead silence from leadership. They will not respond to him, and Boehner will not release the votes in the steering committee. Now, if you've got the chairman of the steering committee saying, we didn't do this, then what you've got is John Boehner spinning a tale here and that he's about to get caught up in the web of.
Well, Barry, just to give you an idea that the rats are leaving the sinking ship, and I don't want to necessarily characterize this person as a rat. Actually, I think he's a pretty decent guy. Jim DeMint is resigning his seat in the Senate. I just found a headline on this to go over and run the Heritage Foundation.
Yes, he just resigned. As of Thursday, he announced his resignation from the United States Senate to go and become the head of the Heritage Foundation because he thinks he can get more done from a think tank standpoint in getting policy going the right way than he can as a voting member of the United States Senate. Now, Chuck, that in itself is absolutely stunning. I'm sure we'll find out more about this over the weekend as this develops. But Jim DeMint has been one of the guys who stood for a long time against the rapid and irresponsible growth of government and against leadership basically capitulating to the Democrats at every chance they could get.
Well, this is just a sign that we are really beginning to come to a serious crisis in government. And it is a serious crisis in government that's coming about because of a serious crisis in leadership. The GOP is basically sitting around spinning yarns about why they're losing elections and blaming you and me and those of us who want small government, small spending, small taxes, less government interference in business, and saying that we're not being realistic, that big government conservatism is the way to go. And in so doing, we have to become more and more and more like the Democrats because they're winning elections. Barry, the reason we're losing, I'm not a Republican.
I was going to say, don't use that royal we.
Yeah. The reason that the Republicans are losing elections is precisely because they are abandoning those very principles. If you recall, who's the biggest hero right now in the last 40 years in the Republican Party?
In the last 40 years?
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan.
What is Ronald Reagan's reputation, even though it's not necessarily well-deserved?
Oh, that he was a fiscal conservative, that he was a hawk on defense, that he actually cut government spending.
Yeah, which, of course, is the only possibility that's in there is a hawk on defense. And really, if you think about what we did militarily, well, we invaded Grenada.
Yes, that's about it.
And we supported some, well, really freedom fighters who were fighting against a Marxist incursion into Nicaragua. And let's face it, they broke the law in doing so. The law was very clear. Congress passed it. It got signed. The fact is they broke the law to send arms. They came up with this scheme. So Reagan's reputation, but let's not go there. The fact is, if another Ronald Reagan came along, if John Boehner were suddenly to be inhabited by Ronald Reagan's ghost, and he talked like him, and he acted like him, and he did the things that Reagan was willing to do, and he took the slugs that Reagan was willing to take, and was willing to do the things that Reagan was willing to do, he'd get elected president. Now, this shows that we are way too dependent on who the president is. As a society,
oh, absolutely.
We have turned the presidents into an elected king. That is a recipe for disaster. And it's that disaster is beginning to show. The fact is that the House and the Senate sit around and say, well, we'll let the executive branch lead the way on this one. That is not how the founders designed our republic. The republic was designed, and don't let anybody kid you, is there one of the branches that's top-heavy in power? And the answer is yes, it's Congress.
And there's a reason for that.
That's right. The bulk of power in the federal government, despite what many of our conservative friends want us to think, the bulk of power is in Congress. Every 4 years, we get tied up in this thing about how we have to do this and this and this and this and get the right president appointed, because that's how we're going to get Supreme Court nominees. If Congress were doing their job, if government hadn't been restructured to remove federalism from the picture, we wouldn't be having these problems. The vast majority of the problems we have had is when we monkeyed with the founders' original design for government.
That's exactly right.
And the fact is that if Congress could very easily rein in the executive branch and very easily rein in the courts, and all it would take would be, maybe three or four impeachment trials? Or simply saying no to any nominee who doesn't take an originalist view to the Constitution? But the fact is that so many of them have gone to law schools where they learned constitutional law, not out of the Constitution, but as a case law approach. Well, there's nothing, Barry, you and I both know, because we're advocates of biblical law. We understand case law approaches. There is case law in the Bible, but you don't rely solely on that. You look at the original law, and then you look at the case law that goes to it. Well, the original law is the Constitution. Barry, I have talked to people specifically who went through law school, took constitutional law classes, never once have cracked the United States Constitution. And will tell you
exactly
that the Constitution is whatever the court says it is.
Which is absolutely, without a doubt, untrue.
Oh, well, we're preaching to the choir here. The fact is that the bulk of power lies in the Congress, and the Congress has that power in the enumerated powers, in the area of the enumerated powers, because the people allow them to have it. Folks, we have to remember that these guys get elected. You can't look at your congressman and say, well, he's not as bad as the other one, so I'm going to vote for him.
But that's what most of them do, Chuck.
Oh, exactly.
I you hear that oftentimes that, well, you know, and that was the whole thing with term limits. Well, you know, we need term limits, but not for my guy. He's great. Although that was said in a vacuum because they really didn't know in any way, shape, or form what their guy had actually been doing in Congress to make him so great.
And, you know, when you pointed out to them what their guy is doing, they get mad at you. How dare you say that about my congressman? How dare you say, how many times have we been in meetings where we've made statements well, Barry and I like to play good cop, bad cop. You may be able to tell from this radio broadcast I'm bad cop. And
I think I've been taking that role today.
I'm generally bad cop, and I'm the guy who says the outrageous things. And people just come unglued. And then later they come to you and say, like 6 months later or a year later, you know, you were right about
that. Yeah, you were right about that.
I don't know how many times I've heard that, Barry. It's one of the most exasperating things I think I hear at the things that we go to. It's, gosh, you were right about that. I wish I'd listened to you. Yeah, well, thank you. It's a little late. How about listening to me next time? And, of course, I'm back to being a pariah by the time, you know, these things. Well, you're wrong about them. So, but that's crying in our beer, and we don't want to do that. We want to be positive about that. So, ladies and gentlemen, come take one of our classes. Learn how your government is supposed to work, and do what some of the people in Barry's classes have done. Run for office.
And I may proudly say, win office.
Right. Barry has what, two office
we
holders?
We now have two state delegates, which is our equivalent of representatives. In the West Virginia, they're going to be sworn in next month in the West Virginia State House of Delegates. Two men who took the Constitution classes that I was offering here in southeastern Ohio, and who, after taking the classes, ran for office for their first time that they'd ever run for anything, Chuck, and they both won seats in the West Virginia House of Delegates.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's exactly why we do this.
It is exactly the reason why we do this.
We're out of time, but please contact us to set up and teach you a class on the Constitution where you can get a truly originalist view of how the government is supposed to work. Believe me, when you take our class, it's an eye-opener. It really is. How many times, Barry, have we been told, I never understood why that was there, and now I understand it fully?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's regular. And Chuck, you know, as we do, ladies and gentlemen, if you've ever taken the class from us and you want to come back and do a refresher, or you want to continue on, or if you missed a class or two and you just want to fill in, you know, as long as you keep your materials, you're an alumni, and alumni can take the class again at no charge. So it's a great. I've got students right now who are setting in for their second and third times on these classes, and they say, I want to learn to teach it like you guys teach it, and I really want to teach this. So I'm going to sit here and take this class a couple of times so I can figure out how to teach it.
Yeah, we've actually intimidated some people, and we tell them you don't have to understand it on our level. You will eventually. That being said, we're out of time. Hey, get a hold of us at www.principledpolicy.com. Take one of our Institute on the Constitution classes. And just, we're looking forward to teaching more and more and more of these classes, getting them going in cycles and having you teach one. So please contact us again at www.principledpolicy.com. And join us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies.